Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Board Game Barbecue. This is Jules, your host here, and it is episode 256, brought to you by Advent Games and our wonderful Patreons. I'm not doing this alone, however. We don't do solo episodes around here. I have also Def with me. How are you doing, Def?
I'm good. I mean, we could be doing solo episodes if Mitch was here.
That's true.
It's fine.
Yeah.
We are deviating from the script today anyway.
That's true. It was unplanned to be just the two of us, but here we are. I'm sure that we'll have some things to talk about. So I'll just kick us off, Def, with some games I've been playing recently, and I think we've got a little bit of crossover here, so let's start at that point. Bear Raid.
Oh, man.
I got to play it recently. Sarah taught it to me, and it was really funny. She started by saying, look, this is a game that Ryan described as just a silly game. It's not serious. It's just a bunch of stocks. You manipulate them and people get points.
Ryan being the designer, Ryan Courtney.
Correct. Ryan Courtney being the designer, but that is not how it came across. What about your thoughts on it?
I thought it was crazy fun. I thought it was uncontrollable fun in terms of it's not really a strategic game. It's to explain it to people how this works, it's meant to be a quick stock manipulation game where you have a number of companies equal to the number of players. And on your turn, you can either buy or short stock in one of these companies, or you can grab some of the dice that are sitting on these companies, and they all have like a number of dice in the game. Some of them might be out of the bag, which is drawn randomly at the start. Some of them might not be. They might still be in the bag. But the trick with the dice is, depending on the sum of the pips on the dice for a company, you have a card for each company that says, hey, If the sum of the pips for this company is, you know, above 16 or above 12 or whatever, something happens to the stock value at the end of the round. But you don't know exactly how much that's going to be because you roll the dice at the end of the round.
Yeah, that's right. It's really funny because even though it's supposed to be a light, silly stock manipulation game, I think as I've thought about the game in weeks since I've played it now, I think the one element that makes it go from a game that some people take quite seriously and try to math out to potentially a party game would be if you just flipped over the cards that you mentioned that adjust the stocks based on the dice pips, if the ones coming for the next round were face down and you couldn't see it, then you wouldn't plan as hard. Because I certainly found that I was going, right, this company, I'm going to make sure that I have lots of dice there, and hopefully the stocks go up, but I'm going to try and sell them before the next round because I could see it's going to drop down if the dice are still there. But there's so much wackiness and unpredictability that it is hard to predict everything, hence why, you know, Ryan said it's just meant to be a silly game. But I couldn't help, and everyone else at the table couldn't help but trying to crunch the numbers. It was just, it's like an instinctual thing that we couldn't get away from.
It is, and I think part of what you just said there reminded me of the game that we had with a few friends here a couple of weeks ago, where what happens with these companies is they have these 10 shares that reset at the start of each round, and if a company's stock value goes above the highest possible value, which is 25, I think.
I think so.
45, or, I can't remember now. What happens is the stock splits, which means everybody that has stock already in this company doubles it.
Yes.
And all of this happens behind screens, player screens, by the way. So you don't really know what's going on and who's got invested to what, apart from, you know, watching what they're doing during the game, which you think you can keep track of. And second round already, you completely lost track of what's going on. But the funniest bit is when a company's stock value goes at the very bottom, it goes bankrupt.
Yeah.
And everybody that has stock from that company removes it completely, and it comes back as a completely new company. So if you have shorted stock of that company, that is free money. That is fantastic because you, you shorted some stock and got some real good cash. And instead of owning the money, now the company's gone bankrupt, you toss these tokens away and you start fresh. And I think that's where a lot of the shenanigans we had in our game happened, around people tanking some companies because they had shorted too much of their stock.
Yeah, we had one company go bankrupt, but it wasn't one that anyone had any consequential amount of stocks in, whether they were shorted or actually invested. However, one of the companies split like four times.
Oh, wow.
And so I thought I had the most of that stock, but it turns out Harry had actually gone harder on it and he didn't have any stocks in anything else. And so that just doubled and doubled and doubled. And I think he had like 30-something stocks by the end of it in the one company. It was just, yeah, it was good fun, that one. Bear Raid was really, really good fun, but it's really hard not to get into trying to crunch the numbers and plan ahead for the next round. But at the end of the day, there's some random dice rolling, which can really swing things. But, I don't know.
I think the player decision there is also pretty good because you can choose to release the dice from behind your screen, or you can choose to lock them on the card that accepts the dice that will be rolled at the end of the round. Mm-hmm. So there's some pretty significant ways you can influence the outcome of that round. And you can see the card that is coming up on the next round for each company. So like you said, you can try and manipulate it a bit. But I think it is going to be enjoyed more by groups that see this as it's not QE. It's not like a completely silly party game, but it's slightly more than that. Not a super serious, I'm going to math this out, I'm going to strategize the world out of this, you know. Yeah. I don't think that's the deal. And it's supposed to be a quick game as well, probably, what, an hour game? And you can play it with four, you can play it with five, you can play it with six players. Yes. So I think it's a very clever design. And I think if people approach it this way, that the design Ryan Courtney intended that you mentioned, I think they're going to have a lot of fun with this one.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it took so long for my head to get around how the stock's value went up and down with the dice rolls, and depending on if it was in the bear or the bull section.
Yes.
There was a bit of symbology that took forever for me to get my head around. But once it did and it clicked, I was like, oh, okay, this is really straightforward.
Yeah.
But yeah, Bear Raid, that was really good fun.
Well, there you go.
What have you been playing, Jeff?
I've been playing quite a few things, but in a slightly different way. So what happened was, recently I've been playing more with my brother. Ever since I got back from Greece, he got hooked on heavier games. And
yes,
Gaia Project been one of them. But maybe a month ago, I taught him Barrage.
Oh.
And even though this was like only a two-player game, he was immediately very interested. Like, you could see it, right? And then the second time, he goes, this is a fantastic game.
He didn't have that whole thing where he's like, this is good, but it's not my project.
We didn't have that this time because I reckon this is now one of his favorites together with Gaia Project. So, and I was just looking at the stats before, and we've played it in the last 30 days. We've played this 9 times.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And we've now included the expansion as well.
Mm-hmm. The Leewater expansion. Arena,
the Leewater expansion.
Yep.
And we've also played with an Automa a few times. So, like a 3-player game. And, you know, he's really, really obsessed with it. And so it's been interesting for me to see him going from, I'm a casual gamer, I don't really like playing board games, if I want to play something, I'm going to play a video game, that's my thing.
Yep.
To, oh, these clans of Caledonia beat these... He's cool. Let's play that again, which, you know, happened last year. And then within 12 months, he's like playing Baraz 10 times a month. And he's like looking for more ways to play it more.
So do you think, obviously, I'm assuming you're playing this over Board Game Arena.
Yes.
Do you think that that website may have been just that little bit of a taking the edge off that it's in a video game form technically? For him to be more accessible, like has made the games just a little bit more accessible?
I think that's a very good point because you've touched on a very, you know, I think the line between video gaming and board gaming is not as clear as I thought it was. Because, you know, I played Gloomhaven on the Steam app. Is that a board game or a video game?
Yeah, you know there I mean? You go. Like
Or even some of the other implementations like Root or Spirit Island. If yeah. the board games did not exist, these games would be perfectly standing fine on their own on the Steam environment, you know, yep. for PC gamers. Like, I don't see a reason why they wouldn't. And so I think with Board Game Arena, it helps that bridge, you know, people to cross that bridge easier, but also... Because it automates all of the admin and all of the counting and all of the fiddly bits that a game may have, it is a massive difference to not have to worry about rules or
yeah.
can I do this? Well, if it's highlighted, you can probably do it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that makes a massive difference. Having said that, I do think, like, at the end of the day, and I spoke about this in an episode where I spoke about, you know, playing games with him in person when I was in Greece a couple of months ago, that mm-hmm. I think video gamers have a physical tendency to get into board games easier.
Yeah.
Because it's the concept of, oh, I'm going to play a game to have fun. And I do think that that plays a massive role.
Yeah.
But I don't know if we would have this spread and this success without Board Game Arena.
Yeah, it's been quite interesting to see since we started the podcast, so roughly 3 years ago, how many more people are spending more and more time on Board Game Arena as that way to fill in their extra time just playing a few more games or trying new things. It's I feel it's starting to change the dynamic of how people engage with the hobby a little bit.
And the other thing is, on Board Game Arena, you now have a massive amount of games that
catalog.
We wouldn't even dream of. You have, I taught him Anachrony last night.
Yeah, there you go.
Because we met again and he's like, do you want to play a game? And I said, I do, but I don't want to play Baraz for the 10th time in 3 weeks or whatever. And so he suggested Gaia Project, but it was like, you know, 10:30 p.m. already, and I said, how about I teach you Anachrony finally? And we went through Anachrony, and because of all the, again, same thing, if the action is highlighted, you know you can take it. If it's yes. not highlighted, just don't worry about it.
Yep.
You might think, oh, hang on, why cannot I do this action? And then you kind of, it helps you learn the game much quicker. And I know, like, Anachrony has this, I guess, reputation for being a complex and difficult game to play. But, you know, I think a significant part of that is just the iconography, the big scale bowl of icons that David Turtsey refers to. And Board Game Arena solves a lot of that because you can just hover your button over and says, oh, that's what that means. Okay.
Yeah, it has a massive wall of icons to deal with. But you're right. I think that Board Game Arena is making some games, not all of them, but some games really easy to learn. I think it's also spoiling us on some games as well, with setup that is just done in 2 seconds and things like that. I mean, Gloomhaven's being an example of that, that you just don't have to set up all the dungeon tiles and bits and pieces. So.
Yeah. That's a good point, but I'm a bit torn with that. Like, I agree in terms of Gloomhaven, for instance, I would happily only play the video game adaptation, which essentially is the board game. I'm not talking, because there is, I think, an actual video game.
Yeah, there is.
I'm talking about the actual board game in the digital app, the digital form.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of games, or most of the games I've played lately, where I thought, you know what, if I had the choice, I would 100% prefer to, you know, play this on the table. I don't care if I would spend half an hour setting up and half an hour packing, because for me, that's mostly, like, it's part of the fun for me. Like, I enjoy the tactile experience.
Absolutely.
But of course, you know, you might not have the luxury of time all the time, which is, you know, what you're referring to. And so I think it's very valid. And I wonder if we're going to see more platforms come up. I saw that Chip Theory Games released their latest light or small game, 20 Strong, in a new platform.
I did see that, yes.
I haven't tried it yet. And
no,
to be
perfectly
honest, I can't remember even what the platform is called, but it's a new one I've never heard before.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have 18xx.games, which is all the 18xx games, and a similar platform now called Rally the Troops, which historical and war games are being ported there with the designer's help. So I think this is only going to grow, and I think this is a great thing for board games because it will help spread the word a lot more.
And I agree.
As a result, we'll get more, you know, money into that industry to make publishing a board game maybe more lucrative, so that we have more designs coming out. I mean, we already have a lot of games, a lot more games coming out each year now. I don't think there's a threat there for the physical versions of these games. If a game is good, you want to play it on the table, in all honesty.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. But circling back to your brother in Barrage, what did he actually think of it?
Yeah, he's obsessed with it now. He thought it was absolutely fantastic. Interestingly enough, he 100% agreed with the opinion I and Adrian both have about it. And I think most of our team members that have played it have it, that once you play with the expansion, the Lee Water Project expansion, then you can't really get back to the base game. I showed him the expansion. We played a few times, and then it was one day that I wasn't available, and he actually seeked a random game to join online. Very, you know, first time thing for him.
Okay.
And I asked him the next day, how'd that go? And he said, well, it was just a base game and I didn't think it was that good. Which I was surprised. Like, I am still coming to terms with him, you know, holding games in such high regard and trashing them so quickly. because I still think Barrage is a fantastic game, even just a base game. Like, if I had the choice, I would always play with the expansion. But I wouldn't avoid playing it just the base game. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So
that's really cool.
There you go. What else has been happening? Don't tell me you started another KDM campaign. I'm going to jump out the window.
I've started another KDM campaign.
Oh, come on.
Well,
I
shouldn't say another. I mean, I've started the only one I have going on at the moment, because the other ones I was playing were back in Melbourne with people and I'm not there anymore. So it's been a while since I've played, and with the Gambler's Chest expansion for the game delivering all over the world at the moment, I've been very excited to play it. I've built a bunch of the models out of that box.
Yeah, just to remind everybody, KDM stands for Kingdom Death Monster.
That's right. And I've been really enjoying looking through all the new content. However, this feeling sitting in my stomach of just going, I have not played the base game nearly enough, not even remotely close enough to even consider touching this giant box of expansion goodness yet. I need to get through more of this game before I consider doing that. So I got sick of it. I'm like, right, I am going to start playing this game. I have a group that are interested in playing, and we're going to try and find a time to get started. But yesterday, I just had enough. I swept everything off my painting desk.
Uh-oh.
And I set up the KDM board. I said, right, it actually fits on the desk and there's enough room to put all the cards that I need accessible. This is going to happen. So I probably started that at about maybe 10:30, 11 o'clock. And then when I went to get up and sort of get a drink of water and have a look at what's going on else around that place, it was about 4:30.
Okay.
So fair I enough. Really got sucked in. And
well, that's fantastic, though. That's what you want out of these games.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, Kingdom Death Monster, as we've mentioned before, it's a boss battler, but there's also a lot of admin that some people call it, although I don't think it's quite fair to call it admin because it's such a big part of the game of deciding how you're going to spend your resources, of deciding who's going to go out and do the hunt, what technologies do you want to develop. That all falls under the admin sort of category because you're filling out information on pieces of sheets and keeping track of what resources you have. But all in all, like that's a really fun part of the game if you feel like you're developing this settlement. And so, yeah, I was just engrossed for like 6 or more hours yesterday playing on my own.
I have a question about this.
Go for it.
If you start a campaign in Kingdom Death Monster, can you start another campaign in parallel?
I think you absolutely can, yes.
Okay.
Now, the only reason you can do that is because of a fan-made app called Scribe.
I knew where this was going. Yes. This is why I asked, because Danny and I have been, a member of our community that lives close by, have started playing Aeon Trespass Odyssey, which is the less evil twin of Kingdom Death Monster, I guess you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about getting into it and, you know, resuming the campaign one of these days. And then you mentioned the Scribe app, and I looked it up, and the same guy that has made the app for Kingdom Death Monster has made one for Aeon Trespass Odyssey. And I was like, oh, this might come in handy. So that's interesting that, you know, the games are inviting, you know, some digital implementation to help people along with them.
Yeah.
Look, I found that really interesting.
I don't know if there's a cap on the number of campaigns you can have saved in the app. I haven't ever had that issue, but you can have multiple of them saved. And the app's really well designed in that if you're the person that has the campaign saved on your device, when you get a group of friends together, you can actually sync them to that campaign all on different devices, and all the changes they make on their phone sync to the overall campaign save file. It's really well designed, and it just makes the admin a little bit easier because the traditional way, or the way you play it if you don't have the app, is paper and pencil and use erasers when you need to change numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is fine, but it's sometimes fine. Your numbers are going up and down on every second dice roll. So it can be a little bit painful. Now, the next step to that would just be laminating sheets and using whiteboard markers, which is what I did for quite a long time. But then I eventually found the app was just easier to use. So, yes, you can absolutely run multiple campaigns in parallel.
Is the app something that messes with the experience on the table? This is always a worry for me when I use apps for board games, which is almost never. Honestly, I think the only time I used an app has been with ISS Vanguard, which you don't have to. It's just that they've transferred all this, the scripts from the script book to an app.
Mm-hmm.
And there's voice acting and sound effects. Like, they've done a fantastic job. So it hasn't bothered me at all. It has actually helped with the immersion.
Yeah.
But I always have this little fear at the back of my head that, hey, I'm playing a board game because I actually want to get away from my screens.
Yeah.
You know, do you feel that it's getting in the way? Is it getting a lot of usage during a play or a session? Or is it
It not only that bad? Gets a lot of usage in the fights.
Okay.
So it's pretty much I'm using it to keep track of my player sheet. How many hit points does it have in this location? Any changes to, you know, disabilities or abilities that they get along the way, and it can automatically calculate the bonuses that you have rather than you having to look on your sheet and go, okay, I hit on a 5, but I've also got this this injury that then minuses 1 from that. You can just glance at the app and go, okay, that's the number I need to roll. So it makes small things easier. It's not 100% necessary, but the fight is where you're using it most. When I get to building the settlement, I can almost put that to the side and go, right, let's pull out the cards and look at all the cards and decide that together. You can do that via the app, but you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
So I tend to do as much as I can physically, but I use the app to leverage the things that are a little bit more fiddly, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Then I'm looking forward to seeing what it looks like for Aeon Trespass Odyssey once we can resume our campaign. So
Yeah, so that was the bulk of my gaming yesterday. But I have played some other stuff recently that I wanted to mention as well. I got to play Nana, which is 7 for Japanese. Some people have had debates about this, but
there was a massive debate on our Discord for like 3 weeks. What's 7 in Japanese?
But the game is called Nana. It has had re-implementation coming called Trio, which is a South American / Mexican themed one. But the gameplay is so simple. It's a little memory game and a little bit of, you know, push your luck to try and get certain number cards. And Connor's talked about this on a recent episode, so I won't go into a super deep amount of detail, but I kind of just wanted to keep playing this over and over again. You just had those little moments where you ask someone, what's your lowest number? And they pull that out and you've got one of them sitting in your hand and you go, okay, have I seen another one? Do they have the other one? Do I ask the same person again? And we played this a bunch of times when Thomas was here for his holiday. And it was just a good laugh, really good laugh. So many moments of teasing each other. I can't believe you forgot where that number was. And it was so easy to remember. But it was lots of fun. I will absolutely pick up a copy of Trio, I think, when it comes out in retail, because it's just a really easy, approachable thing. Yeah. A lot of people know memory playing as a kid. It's just that with a few numbers, but really simple. I was really surprised by it, how much fun I had.
Well, there you go. That sounds great. I have an interesting one. I played for the first time Hansa Teutonica.
Oh, really?
Yes. It's one of those sort of classic.
I'm keen to hear your thoughts.
Euros that I hadn't played yet, which I played a few days ago, and I really, really enjoyed it. Like, I thought the high player interaction and the decision space was very big. It allowed for all sorts of different strategies. You know, do you go for more actions, unlocking more actions? Do you try to establish a couple of routes so people use them and you get victory points early on? I just thought that there wasn't an obvious way to win it.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely.
And I was also surprised by how much game there was within that very straightforward rule set. It's a game that you can probably teach, you know, what, in 10 minutes, maybe 15?
Yeah, probably about that.
There's no complexity in the actions. They're all very straightforward. It's very straightforward how you gain points. And the high player interaction is a really key part of the game where you sort of place your cubes or your discs expecting to be bumped out because you know somebody wants it more, but then you get additional cubes to place in the adjacent routes and stuff like that. So I was very, very happy I got to play it. If this was something that was, you know, playing well in lower player counts, I would buy it, as is this group that I play with on a weekly basis is probably the only place I would play it. So I'm happy to just play their copy. But I was very, very surprised by it. And I think we've spoken about this the last few days that I think I'm enjoying higher player interaction games more, even Euros lately.
Yeah.
So Hansa was just awesome.
Yeah, it's been quite some time since I've played Hansa Teutonica as well, but my memory of playing the game is just having so much fun, just dropping that cube right in the path that someone's trying to finish and going, oh dear, I guess you'll have to spend more cubes to bump me out.
But like the game is not mean the way, it, you know, maybe it has a reputation or maybe I hadn't studied it properly. I mean, you know, what I heard wasn't exactly accurate, but it's not mean in the sense that, you've played Dominant Species recently. That is a mean game.
That can be very mean.
So in Hansa Teutonica, it's not.
Yeah, like, it's not that.
If somebody
level.
Bumps you out, you benefit from that.
Correct.
So it's not exactly something that somebody does to you or in your face. There's no really a take that kind of element in the game.
No.
But there is very high player interaction, which is fantastic. So there you go. That's something I hadn't played before. One of the classic, I guess, Euros, and I'm very, very happy I got to play it.
Yeah. No, that's cool. The last one before we talk about some sizzling games that I got to try over this past week, which has been talked about before on the podcast, and that's Cat in the Box.
Mm.
Now, if you haven't heard about Cat in the Box, it's a trick-taking game that has a couple of twists to it. First of all, there's no suits. There's just cards with numbers. All of them are black and white cards. But when someone leads a trick, you've got a little card in front of you which has the four colors. I think it's green, blue, yellow, and red. Those are the four suits you can describe it that way. And they'll play a card next to one of those colors on your little indicator card saying, this number three I'm playing is now a yellow. And you'll grab a little disc and you'll pop it over on a central board that has tracks for each of the four numbers ranging from 1 to 13 or so.
Okay.
I don't think all the numbers go quite to 13, but it's around about that number.
A mix, yeah.
Yeah. So what happens is when the person plays down the card, say, cool, I'm playing a three, it's next to yellow, so that's a three yellow. They grab one of their player discs and they put it on top of the three in the yellow track. That is the lead color. And so if you want to play the same color, you just pick a card from your hand, put it next to the yellow, but the number needs to be available on the board. Now, as the round progresses, these tokens you put down on numbers, and depending on which color you allocated it to, will start to fill up.
Ah.
If you decide to break suit, for example, let's say I played a three yellow and Def wanted to play another number but not yellow, he can do that. He goes, all right, I'm going to put a five down next to my green. Because he broke the yellow suit, he takes a disc off the yellow on his indicator board and then uses that token to put it on top of the green five, which you've played. It now means you cannot play yellow cards the rest of the game for that round. So you sort of have to decide these moments at where you're going to break the suit, meaning you cannot play that color anymore. It's done. Now, the really clever thing about this is you, at the start of a round, are declaring how many tricks you want to win. And you get points for every trick you win, even if you go under the amount you said or over.
Okay.
However, if you get exactly the right amount of tricks you said, you get bonus points. And how you collect those bonus points is when you're choosing numbers and colors to put those tokens on the board, you're trying to make them in as big as an adjacent cluster as you can. Because the bigger that cluster is, the more bonus points you get. That's where it starts to become a little bit of an area majority game because the numbers are not lined up because the ones aren't all in a perfectly vertical column. They're all offset. So the numbers start to line up in different ways. And you have trying to make this orthogonally adjacent cluster on the board. It's really, really clever. And
You've spoken about this now and Mitch has spoken about this and somebody else has spoken about this. So I'm really curious to play it now. Is this still a game that would be enjoyable by a big group of players?
Yes.
Or is this so you need the four or the five or whatever.
I think it's probably more enjoyable with more because of this fact. One of the points of tension of the game is the paradoxes. What that is is if a player gets to a point where they have numbers that are not available on the board, or they can't play any of the colors that the trick is leading in. So if they get to a point where it's literally impossible for them to play a card, they cause a paradox and they lose points for all of their tricks. And then the round ends.
Okay.
So it's got this point of tension that's always there, and I think that comes more quickly with more players. Now, I think you do adjust the deck of cards if there's less players, so maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is still got quite a bit of tension at lower player counts, but I played it at 4 players, and I thought it was brilliant.
That's fantastic.
But, yeah, that's...
I'm very curious to try it.
Yeah, that's Cat in the Box. I think it's a really unique trick-taking game with a fun little twist, and there's going to be a colossal version coming out at some point. A colossal version. I don't know how colossal it will be, but we'll find out. Sizzling Games. Def, do you want to launch into that?
I will launch into that. I will literally launch into that. I know you wanted me to talk about La Granja, which is another classic year I hadn't played, and got the deluxe version. But I'm not going to.
Okay.
I'm not going to. I want to talk about a space-themed game. Space Corp 2025 to 2300 AD, which is a game from John Butterfield that's published by GMT Games. It's not a new game. It's been on the market for a number of years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I had seen some playthroughs that Paul Grogan did on his channel. It must have been a couple of years ago, at least now, and I thought it looked like a pretty solid design.
Mm-hmm.
I avoided buying it until very recently, and I got it together with the expansion that offers some variability and some, I think, corporations, it's called. But essentially, Space Corp is a pretty straightforward, I guess, tableau builder Euro game, you'd call it. I'm not quite sure what you would call it, but essentially the way it works is the game happens over 3 eras, and in the first era you're exploring the immediate solar neighborhood, which is basically Earth and the neighborhood and up until Mars. And the game is very abstracted, but actually gives you some very interesting decision space, because the way it works is there is a tableau or a display, I guess you would call it better, of cards that have very simple information on them. They say move one or move two or build one or research one, or there's like 4 or 5 actions in the game. That's it. That's all there is. And you have different thresholds that you have to meet in order to take these actions. So, for instance, to take off from Earth, you need one move because you have to defeat the planet's gravity.
Yes.
And then the map is divided into these sections. And so to get, from Earth to the moon, it doesn't require any additional movement points. You only require one to land, because you always need one to land or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to cross sections and you want to go and land on, Mars or on the one of the satellites of Mars, or if you want to try and get further, it actually you cross these points. If you want to go to one of the Lagrange points, for instance. So you have to spend more movement points in order to reach further away. And you have these teams, which are simply cubes that you've got. And you have a limited amount of them. And the way it works is you move around these different areas. You land, then you have to explore. There's some exploration tiles that sometimes give you things or sometimes hurt you, or they give you some capability to build something there. You have build actions that you can use to build different types of structures. It depends on where you are and what you can build. But the way it works is you basically have a hand of cards, and you have your own player board that you have your own tableau of 4 cards. When you start the game, there's pre-printed. A couple of these are pre-printed, like a move one and research one or whatever. And as you go on during the game, one of the actions you can take is upgrade, which means placing one of the cards in your hand on your tableau, either covering a pre-printed action or replacing a card that's already there. And as you can suspect, the deck that feeds the offer or the display of the cards that are available becomes richer with better cards as the game progresses. When I first saw this, I thought it was, you know, a bit of a too simple game, I guess you would call it. It was the time when I was, you know, really getting into On Mars and Gaia Project.
Yep,
and
okay.
I thought, well, this, you know, looks much, much simpler. I don't know how much game there is in it. But hear me out how this works. The game has three different main boards. So yep. In the first era, which is the Mariner's era, the game calls it, you only go up to Mars. And when somebody crosses that first threshold and gets to the place beyond that, then there's a couple of end of era triggers or end of game
sure.
triggers.
Yep.
And then you finish that and you take the second board, which is the entire solar system.
Oh,
and
okay.
has all the planets. And so all of a sudden, you now have the space that you had in the first board is now shrunk into this corner of the map to allow for the scale to display the rest of it.
So do you actually get rid of the first board and put down a brand new one?
You get rid of the first board completely.
Okay.
And then once you finish that, you flip that board on the other side and you have your sort of solar your galactic neighborhood now, where the parts of the board are different galaxies, neighboring galaxies that you can visit. And so again, the whole solar system gets shrunk into this tiny dot on the map, which is the previous board that you were using.
That's interesting.
And at the same time, the first era is a much simpler rule set to get through, but Eras 2 and 3, they introduce this display of breakthrough cards, and it has a couple of new concepts around researching and a couple of other things. And so it gives you some super special abilities. So, for instance, as soon as you get into the second era, you cannot travel anymore because of radiation in space. And so your move action or your travel action has to be shielded, which means one of two things. Either the action itself needs to say move three shielded, which, as you can suspect, is less cards than the ones that are not shielded action, or you need to build a shield generator building from where you're flying out of.
Right, okay.
But I found one of the things that I really enjoyed is this progress in scale from, you know, our local neighborhood here from Earth to Mars to the second bit, the whole solar system, and the third bit, the neighboring galaxies. The progress of the game is very, very good. At the start, you have, you know, the movement that you need to get from Earth to Mars is like six. So you need 6 points of movement. On the third map, you need to generate movement points of like 80, 90, 100 to get to from one galaxy to another. And so
wow,
you have this sense of progress as you are upgrading your cards from move one and move two to, you know, move six and move times three, where you start making multiplications of your movement capabilities to get to 50 or 60 movement. And the same goes for building and everything else that you need to do in the game. And you score points based on fulfilling different contracts, like, you know, there's, for instance, stuff that come up during the game that you have to fulfill, like, you know, have four bases of on the same zone, or, you know, colonize some of the galaxies on the last board and stuff like that. On top of that, the game comes with a very good solo mode, which basically represents a human player.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first game that I've seen that does this. When you open the box, you see there's two rule books. There's one for the normal game and one for the solo game. That's fair enough. All the games that have solo mode have
nothing
this.
Nothing unusual.
Well, actually, in Space Corp, what happens is if you want to play the solo game, you don't need to read the main rule book at all. You just read the solo rule book. So the two rule books are the full game explanation, except from whether you're playing multiplayer or solo. So the solo rule book doesn't actually explain just the solo rules. It explains you the whole game.
Oh, okay.
So I thought that was an interesting decision. I didn't mind it at all. Like, I had no problem learning the game that way. Besides, the game is pretty similar whether you're playing it multiplayer or solo. Mm-hmm. In solo mode, you play against the competition, which is like this corporation that competes with you.
Yep.
And yeah, like I just finished a full game a couple of days ago and I had a great time with this. It does give you this feel of a more classic design, if you like.
That's a funny way of putting it.
Yeah, but like it does certain things that, you know, the aspects of the design and the mechanics, they're not going to blow you away.
Yeah.
But the things it does really, really well.
So the reason I laughed there is I'm looking at pictures of the game right now and the classic design. It's a pretty basic looking map on the board.
Yeah, yeah.
It gives me vibes of Beyond the Sun.
Yes.
That's the visual aesthetic that I think it fits in with.
Okay.
Yeah. That's just very minimalistic. Like, I mean, there's not many ways you can display space. It's a black void.
Right. you have to be pretty creative. And
so, like, you know, I can't be too critical of it, but it's essentially got, you know, I think it's at least the third year of board. It's a blackboard and it's got some abstracted rings that represent different regions. And it doesn't look very pretty, but I understand what it's trying to do.
Look, you got to fix this, Jules. Like, you said the same thing about Gaia Project. And like it does.
Gaia Project looks gorgeous compared to this.
Okay, I'll allow that. But my point is, you know, I think that if the game is good, and I think the art is actually pretty fitting for this.
Sure, yeah, of course.
And the cards are pretty, you know, they don't have art on them. They're pretty basic, but they convey the information in a very clear way that you have to sort of really make them out on what's on offer and what you can take and that sort of stuff. But yeah, look, I'm looking forward to showing this to a couple of people and see what they think, because I think you could have a great deal of fun with this one, especially when you play in a multiplayer game with maybe two or three people.
Mm-hmm.
The competition is going to be, you know, more realistic than in the solo mode, which does a very, very good job anyway. But yeah, I would love to see how this plays with more people. And yeah, this has been a successful, you know, attempt, I guess, for me. There's some of these games that you kind of look at and go, yeah, this looks good, but I don't know how much I would play it. And then, you know, you get to try it and you stand on one or the other side of that fence. I think this one falls on the correct side for me. I really enjoy the theme, obviously, and that plays a massive role, I guess, massive part for me. I always prefer games where I can make a connection with the theme.
Yeah, that's
and
cool.
Like, for instance, in the third board where you have to travel to these faraway galaxies, when you travel to them, you don't automatically go to the actual stars of those galaxies. There's like this progression, this track of three or four boxes where you place your cube on the first one, and then at the start of each round, you progress that one.
Mm-hmm.
And when it jumps off the track, that means you've arrived or that the information has come back from your arrival, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very abstracted, but it does give me the feel that I'm looking for from this kind of game.
That's cool.
It can be a bit of a long game, I think, especially if you play with, you know, three or four players. Because remember, we're talking about three different eras, and even just going through, you know, one of them would probably take about, you know, 45 minutes to an hour. So it could be a sure. longer than 3 hour game. But at the same time, you don't have to play all three eras. You could play two of them if you want and just call it
yeah,
there.
Okay.
Because what happens is the game just loops through the same kind of activity and action selection and scoring during the game. And there's a tiny bit of scoring at the end, but nothing too crazy.
But where you finish for the previous round is sort of your launching point for the next, or is
correct.
It? Correct. Okay, yeah. Oh, that's cool.
So that's Space Corp 2025 to 2300 AD. And I'll definitely be playing more of this. I wonder if this is one of these games where people would want to learn that at a game day, at one of our game days, because it's one of these games where you don't easily find somebody has a copy.
No, it's a GMT published game.
Correct. So
yeah, but it's only got a weight rating of 2.95. So
yeah, the game is very straightforward. Like you can only do three or four things, mm-hmm. and the tension points in the game are where you are going and where your competitors are going. And there is a bit of interaction because you can use, you know, their bases or if there's an exploration tile, and then you can go and build after somebody explores there. There are some points that you can have some interaction with the other players.
Mm-hmm.
It's not area control per se. It's just, you know, who will get there first and who will get the bonus first and stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so far it's been a success for me. Remains to be seen how much it stands the test of time. As usual with my games, I want to try and play them on repeat and see how much they, you know, they dry up or they remain interesting after a few plays. But so far I've been pretty happy with this.
Yeah, oh, that's really cool. I'm always keen to try new things. And, you know, since I've played Andean Abyss by GMT and had a taste for, obviously the coin series is not representative of all the stuff they do.
Sure.
But I was quite impressed with it. And so I'm keen to try more of the titles in the catalog. So yeah, very good. Space Corp.
That's it. What about yourself? What's your sizzling game for this
week?
Well,
I'm going to shift gears just a smidge. No, nothing too drastic. My sizzling game for this week is a Kickstarter that has been arriving or should have arrived for a lot of people by now if they backed it, and that is the new title from Flatout Games, Fit to Print.
Oh, yes.
Now, I talked about this game a while ago because I was able to play an early copy when it was on mm-hmm. Kickstarter, but man, this game, so good.
Okay, so you say what I'm hearing is I should be regretting not backing this, is what you're saying.
You should be regretting it more than anything you have in your life.
Oh, wow.
Look, I mean, it's a bit extreme. Those are strong words. But I really adore this game. And it was very inexpensive. Flatout are so good with their pricing on Kickstarter. From my memory, it was $29.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, whatever the shipping is, which is not yes. outrageous. But I was in a group buy, so it was very, very reasonable. And I know this will be coming to retail, so don't worry. That will come out. Fit to Print. So, I don't know the exact designer's name. I'll have to look that up in a bit. But the artwork's Ian O'Toole, who we all know and love. And it's a very charming game. So, Fit to Print, you are playing as someone managing a newspaper in a woodland anthropomorphic creature sort of realm. The theme is nice. It doesn't really matter too much. Although I will say the mechanics of the game is very well tied with the theme. So this is a real-time game. You have to set a timer for each round. This will cause stress and anxiety, and that is absolutely part of the game.
That is where you lost me. That is, I remember now. I'm having flashbacks, right?
Because
the tile laying and all of that, when I remember watching this on Kickstarter, I thought, oh, this is my type of game. I'm backing it. And then when I saw the words real time, I was like, oh, no. So tell me more about it.
Okay. So basically what you need to do is you need to create a layout for a newspaper and publish it. So you have a huge bag of tiles you put in the middle of the table, all face down. And you play over three rounds. You've got to create your Friday, Saturday, and Sunday news spread.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a few extra modules which you can add in that add some little powers and rule changes from round to round. You don't have to use them.
Yeah.
But at its core, at the start of a round, you'll get given a centerpiece article. And that has to go on your player board covering a star, which is located in the upper half of the newspaper. And it gives you your own unique scoring objective for that round.
Oh, it's pretty clever.
Yeah. So, when you go 3, 2, 1, go, you start your timer. You can do either 3, 4, or 5 minutes, the rule book recommends. I prefer maybe 3 minutes because I played it a lot now and I need that pace and that stress to keep the game exciting, I suppose. But basically what you do is you, in real time, you're grabbing pieces from the middle one at a time. You're pulling it over your desk, flipping it over and deciding whether you want to keep it or not. If you don't, you put it back in the middle face up. If you do, you put it on your player desk. And you're going, right? You have the three, let's say it's the 3 minute time, okay? You've got 3 minutes to do two things. One, collect all the articles and advertisements and pictures and photos that you need that you want to put on your paper. And you need to arrange those tiles as best as you can.
Okay.
So you've got 3 minutes to do all of that. But once you start laying out your newspaper, you're not allowed to grab any more articles. So you have to yell out layout during those 3 minutes. Then you can take them all off your desk and start putting them around. Now, there's a bunch of rules on how you're allowed to lay it out. And this is where it becomes stressful because you're trying to do this all under a time pressure. The first rules are no two things can touch each other that are the same. So you cannot have photos touching each other. You cannot have articles the same color touching each other. You cannot have advertisements touching each other. As well as that, the news articles have happy and sad faces. Now, you want to have a balanced publication with an equal amount of happy and sad news.
Okay. I like it.
And you're trying to meet your unique scoring objective for the round, and you're trying to fill as much of the space as possible. Because how the scoring works from round to round is each of the news articles. Actually, let me take a step back. Once the time has run out, everyone, you know, hands off the newspaper, and the first thing you do is check the validity. Everyone just has to check each other's pages. Have they broken any rules? If you have, you just have to flip one of the tiles face down. It still fills the space.
But it doesn't count.
But it doesn't count towards anything. Mm. And when you're laying out your newspaper, you are absolutely allowed to put tiles down face down. If you realize, oh, man, I've grabbed too many.
Yeah, you can't figure it out yet.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. So it will fill the space, but you won't score anything for it.
Okay.
And it's so well done. The back of the tiles have little scribblings that are sort of blank. It's not just a blank tile. It looks like scratchings for a newspaper. It's really, really well illustrated. So you go around and check the validity, then you score. News articles have point values, so you just add them up. Pictures, what they have is adjacency points. So this picture will say, get 1 point for every blue or pink article touching the edge of this photo. So you've got articles, you've got all these things you don't want touching each other, but then the photos want you to touch certain things. But you've got to make sure that the same things aren't touching. It's just all of that stress in the 3 minute time or however long you're playing really scrambles your brain. And then, of course, advertisements. Advertisements don't give you any points. However, they have little dollar symbols in the corner. And depending on how many dollar symbols, you just keep track of that throughout the rounds. At the end of the third round, whoever has the least amount of dollar symbols accumulated over those rounds ran an unprofitable newspaper and automatically loses. So you've got to put these advertisements
down.
You've got to
make money somehow.
You've got to make the money, but they don't earn you any points. It's just an eligibility requirement to win.
So essentially, you're you saying this is horseless carriage in real time.
It sort of sounds like it a bit.
Basically. And I mean, I don't know where the real-time mechanic comes from. I guess you could say it represents the rush and, you know, the deadlines for first yes, page absolutely. Closings and publication and stuff like that, which is very cool, by the way.
Yep.
But I think, you know, that would be an interesting game to see a few people I know playing.
Yeah.
So it including goes on- myself, because sometimes this title laying stuff can really mess with your head.
Absolutely. It goes up to 6 players as well. So you've got this, okay. this frantic group of people grabbing things from the middle and tossing things back. It's really good fun.
The main question I had for you before we continue is, how much variety is there in these tiles? And is there a situation where you are competing with other people for tiles? Or is there a situation where you're simply just trying to crack the puzzle of the layout for your particular first page? You know, and therefore, it's just a matter of you trying to figure that out as opposed to, oh, I need that tile before the other person because there's only one of them, or it's pretty unique and it suits me specifically.
No, that's a great question. There is definitely not the thing of, I need to grab that tile before someone
else. Okay.
Because they're all rectangle shapes. There's no funny Tetris shapes going on, but the orientation matters. So some are landscape, some are vertical ads, and you have to put everything in the correct orientation.
Yeah.
There's definitely plenty of tiles for every type you need. It's what happens is you're so focused on trying to get a balance of happy and sad or get this particular color next to this thing that you tend to lose focus of, oh, okay, I've grabbed that, but I actually need it in the other orientation. Well, it's too late. I can't do that now. So I'm going to have to figure out a way to fill in as much space as possible. Now, the reason which you want to fill in as much space as possible is if you have the least amount of blank space left over, you get bonus points. But if you have the most, you lose points. However, there is another twist. Every article that you did not put on your page because it didn't fit and that you had to leave on your desk, you lose a point for every tile on your desk that you did not put in the paper.
So, hang on. So, when you're grabbing a tile from the middle,
yep,
you kind of commit to it and then
yes.
the editor goes, nah, we got more important things to talk about on our front page. We'll leave that out. And so, the source gets upset or the article writer gets upset and you lose points.
Yeah. So, it's because you have that 3 minutes to grab your tiles and lay it out. But once you start laying out, you're committed, you can't grab any more. Mm. So you've kind of got it in your brain, visualize this pile of mess on your desk going, I think that's enough to cover it. I don't think I've grabbed too much. But you inevitably either go way too soft and don't grab enough stuff or way too hard.
Yeah,
and the thing is, you have to keep those tiles for the next round as well. You can't ditch the lot. So you've got to go, I've got a bunch of excess advertisements. I don't need to grab as many of those because I didn't put some in last round. It's a very clever game. And the thing I found so enjoyable as well is because you've got Friday, Saturday, Sunday as your 3 rounds, each round the space gets increasingly bigger. So you can't necessarily go, all right, I grabbed too much last round. I know roughly how much I need. No, because the space changes. So you're visually never really with how much you need to grab. I think it's absolutely brilliant game. If you're playing at 5-minute rounds, this game takes maybe 20 minutes to play just with your in-between round scoring.
Yeah.
It's just a laugh. It's so, so good.
The changing of the size that you have available is critical because I was just going
to
ask the question that sounds like a game that you unlock after some
time. You never unlock it.
You know what I mean? Like you kind of figure it out and you know how many tiles or roughly what kind of things you want. Yeah. But if the size is changed from one round to the next, then that I think is enough to get you a bit more scrambled
and look, if that's
keep it fresh.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you play the base game a bunch and somehow you get super familiar with each round, then you can start to throw in the breaking news rules. there's a whole deck of cards, and they have Friday, Saturday, Sunday in the back, and you shuffle those up and you play with one. And it has some game-breaking rule where it goes, all right, you're allowed to have photos touching each other now. And it just, that one element's like, well, I can totally change the way I lay things out now.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's super charming. I've basically taught you all the rules already. I will play this game for a very, very long time. This falls in the realm of like a go-to gateway game to introduce people. Now, granted, it's real time. Some people won't like that and it's stressful. Totally get that. Maybe Cascadia would be my go-to in that case. But this is such a fun game. I really, really love it. And this is an absolute gem.
Yeah. I mean, if people want to play this without the real-time element, I'm sure they can. But
yes, there is a variant in the rule book for just... I don't know what they call it, but yes, there is a variant you can play without a timer.
I guess, you know, at the end of the day, you want to try and experience the game in the way the designers meant for it to be experienced. Yeah. And, you know, if the variant is better for you, then, you know, that's still totally fine. But, yeah, I was half joking before when I said that I didn't back this before because of the real-time element. I don't remember why I didn't back it, to be perfectly honest with you, because the theme... is a lot more interesting to me than these other games that we've had come out the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the way they had gone about, you know, producing the game in the same way as the previous ones in terms of the cost and the sensible production costs and all of that and the price in the end, it just says a lot about a business or a company that is trying to, you know, serve the medium they're involved with, while at the same time obviously trying to make money. So I wanted to support them, and I didn't back it in the end, but I'm glad to hear that it's coming out on retail, so I'm sure that we'll get the opportunity to buy it there when that happens.
Absolutely.
That sounds like a great time, though. How many players does it go up to? Did you already say?
Yeah, it goes up to six.
Six, yes, okay.
And really, it's good at any player count, and the setup doesn't change. You just still throw the whole pile of tiles in the middle of the board, or on the table, I should say, and it still feels frantic because the one bit of player interaction you could say is because if you don't want a tile, you're putting it back face up. With more players, you'll see more face-up tiles, and you go, ah, that's the right size of ad that I need. You don't have to go searching for it kind of thing. Look, player count doesn't really matter. It still feels stressful matter what you're doing. And Mike had mentioned he played this a few weeks ago. If you actually read the articles, there's really cute newspaper articles, and it's actually really well illustrated. It's not just blobs of color. So there you go. That is Fit to Print, my sizzling game for this week.
I'm sold on it.
All right. With all of the sizzling games talked about, I think we're ready to move on to our question of the pod.
If you're looking to add to your board game collection without taking out a second mortgage, then look no further than Advent Games. Dean and the team don't just sell games, they play games, they know games, they love games just like us. The first thing you notice when you head to adventgames.com.au is the amazing range of games. Dean and the team have worked tirelessly to make sure that every game is properly catalogued into the website. You can search by card games, dice games, family games, gateway games, solo games, and games from your favourite designers. And they don't just have games. Advent has a huge range of RPG books, game inserts, organisers, sleeves, even miniatures and scenery to make your next game night an experience to remember. Shipping is a flat $10 if you live in the Sydney metro area, $15 for the rest of Australia. And don't forget, if you sign up for their newsletter, every Friday you receive an email with the latest specials, newest arrivals, and a list of all the games that have just come back into stock. So there's no excuse for missing out on that game that you desperately want in your collection. So why not grab your next sizzling game from Advent Games? Head to adventgames.com.au now.
All right, so before we launch into this week's question, we want to have a recap of last week's question. And that was obviously revolving around Sarah, as it was her last episode. If you haven't listened to that, I highly encourage you to. Sarah's been an absolutely amazing person to work with on this podcast, and we are very, very grateful for all she's done. So we want to just read off a couple of responses to the question of what's your favorite Sarah episode and or sizzle. So a couple of our Facebook responses, we had Lee that said, surely it has to be the one where she spoke about the beige game, which is probably every episode she was on.
Yeah.
We also had James say, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but Sarah is the reason I found the podcast and community in the first place. I followed Tabletop Source on Twitter. By the way, that's the blog that she has. And when she mentioned she'd been on an episode, that was the first one I'd listened to. Obviously, I kept listening and I've made some great friends and memories all thanks to Sarah. I guess to answer the question, I'd have to say episode 106, which was the 24th of May, 2021. Sarah Sizzle's El Grande, in which she had recently taught myself and Jessica at the first Sydney game day. It was a great game and I still remember fondly. She also taught us Tigris and Euphrates, which is now one of our all-time favorites. I'm sure Sarah remembers episode 106 fondly for entirely different reasons. Chris also said, obvious bias, but Guildmaster Sizzle for sure. First time I heard the word biffo too. also, the ep with Isaac Childress, specifically where she asked for a new edition of Forge War. Such a great, messy game. Hope it happens someday. And also, Allison said, miss over Carcassonne. As a Carcassonne fan, I just had to get it, and boy, it's great. First level seemed too easy, but yeah, stuck on level 3, lol.
We had a lot of responses.
We did.
To this question, and because Sarah had announced that she was leaving a few days earlier, there were so many messages on the Discord community as well. A couple of them that we've listed here, Luke said, when Sarah asked about Christmas board games, we interacted about it after I listened to the episode and had a really good chat about Christmas board games versus games that involve Christmas as a setting. And I remember Sarah specifically mentioning this debate, so that's interesting. Chris said, I'm not sure exactly what my favorite moment is from Sarah Moments, but the first one that comes to mind is the one-sentence summary episode of Sarah's top 50. I think it was her top 50 last year. Mm-hmm. Talk about condensing your thoughts down. Yes, Chris, I do remember that episode she did. It was like a top 50 in a breath, literally. It was so quick. I was so impressed with
that. It was a massive solo speed run going through that list. It was really fun to listen to.
So thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on what your favorite episode with Sarah was. And given the circumstances brought this episode to you with just Jules and me today, we thought the new question of the pod would be something that relates to that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the question for this week is, what's the best two-player game you've ever played? Now, I have an immediate answer I can jump in with. I don't know if it's necessarily my top. I should say, this should be the best two-player only game. Not yes. What plays well at two. This is mm-hmm. two-player only, no ifs or buts. The first one that jumps to my mind, Caesar. I really, really love Caesar. So much tense decision making, such a simple rule set. Every decision's actually two decisions in one.
Yeah,
I love Caesar. So good.
We played this together.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was great fun. We've also played Blitzkrieg, which is kind of, I guess,
yep.
They came out together. They kind of are part of the same
mm-hmm.
series. And I'm pretty certain that Sarah, in last week's episode, talked about the third game in the series,
yep.
which is by a different designer and a different take, but it's called Dogfight.
Yeah, I'm very keen to try that.
Yeah, same. But I thought Caesar was a great example of how a small box and a simple rule set can get you the two things that you would always miss from a game if it weren't there. That is relative depth in the gameplay, some kind of decision making.
Yep.
And great fun.
Yes.
So I agree with you. I think Caesar is absolutely fantastic. For me, I think my answer would have to be more of a nostalgic response than anything else.
Okay, yeah.
So if I had to pick a board game that is a two-player only game, I would have to pick Seven Wonders Duel.
Yes,
I've played.
I expect we'll get a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, it was partly the reason why we got into board games more, because Dimi, my partner, and I, we played this game to death, and we had so much fun, and we thought it was so interesting. And, you know, it's one of these games where there's no overhead in rules and all that sort of stuff. And I don't know how far into board games we would have gotten if it wasn't for Seven Wonders Duel. And I think the fact that we still have it after all these years, and, you know, after getting it heavy into complex, big, heavy games, and we still play it today, I think it speaks volumes for me. So I'm not going to cheat and say chess.
Sure, because that's,
you know, that's still a response that I think we're going to get quite a bit. And that also has a special place in my life and in my heart. But in terms of modern board games, I would say Seven Wonders Duel. But let's see what responses the community gives us. I mean, there's so many good, excellent two-player only games, not just small games. I'm thinking, you know, bigger games like War of the Ring or Star Wars Rebellion, or even some of the David Thompson games that we've played, even together, like War Chest and Unwanted.
I think I just want to mention two more. One that has been more recent would actually be Splendor Duel. It's really snappy. It's got a few extra rules that just make it a bit more bitey. And I really found it quite surprising how much I enjoyed that game. It caught me off guard. Okay. And the other one would have to be Android Netrunner. I have quite enjoyed playing that of recent times, and I'm very keen to dive into it a bit more. But, man, that's a game with fantastic tension, lots of bluffing and mind games. Oh, yeah, that's a real good one.
Oh, fantastic.
All right. Well, we're keen to hear from the community. We'll, of course, post this question on our Facebook community and Discord and all the other places you can find us interacting as well. What is the best two-player only game you've ever played? Just before we move on to our last segment, which is Swear an Oath, I just thought I'd do a little bit of news and announcements regarding our game days. We have the Brisbane Game Day coming up on the 2nd of September. Tickets are sold out. So if you do really want to come, there is a wait list. We do usually have some cancellations for whatever reason, so you may still be able to get in if you go on the wait list. So that is going to be a cracking day. We've also got the Sydney Game Day coming up on the 27th of September, and the tickets are available now. So if you want to come along for an epic day, 12 hours of gaming goodness, lots of games to try out. I've been running two rooms in a boom the past two game days there with 20 plus people. At the end of the day, it's been epic. Come along and have a good time.
Can you just repeat the date for the Sydney Game Day, Jules? Because I think you said the 27th of September, which isn't actual date. I think it's the
23rd.
3rd of September,
For some reason,
it's a Saturday.
Always mix that up.
Only reason I remember is because one day after my birthday, so I kind of thought, that doesn't sound quite right. I'll be teaching Pax Pamir and Tammany Hall on the Brisbane Game Day on September 2nd. So let's see how that goes. But I think I've been summoned to play some train games as the night progresses. So we'll see how that goes.
Sounds good. So the Sydney Game Day is on the 23rd of September, and tickets are available right now. Okay, so with that, I think we're ready to move on to our Swear an Oath. Before we find out what has been happening with the oaths, I'll just say a massive thank you to our Patreon supporters. This show would not be possible without you. And a few people to specifically thank this week. We have Matthew Alsop, Megan Moore, Nameless Adventurer, Nathan Woodrow, Nikki Wilson, and David Rojas. Thank you so much, all of you, for supporting the show. It means the world to us.
Thank you, everyone.
You can also support us by giving us a podcast rating, going to Spotify or Apple Podcasts, joining the Facebook community or the Discord community. You can interact with us there, talk about all the favorite games that you've been playing. All of those things help us to get into the interwebs that people can see us more and more. We thank you for all the support you've been giving us. It's really, really awesome, and we can't wait to interact with you all more. All right, swearing oath time. So, Def.
Oh, come on now.
I know you haven't had a chance to do yours because it hasn't lapsed around yet.
I mean, I literally said on the previous episode, I said, I'm going to cheat a little bit because I'm going to swear an oath to play Tammany Hall, which I knew was going to happen in the game day, but
the game day
is next week or in 2 weeks' time.
So that's all right.
It hasn't happened yet.
The challenge was set for a specific time. It hasn't happened yet. So
that's okay. But I'm going to swear an additional oath. And I feel like this needs to be a special episode at some point because I've been getting deep into the rabbit hole of cube rail games. Games that, you know, sort of, well, not spin off from Age of Steam, but games like Chicago Express or Trans-Siberian Railroad or, you know, Iberian Gauge and Age of Rail that was recently on Kickstarter, all the old Winsome games. So, and I've been watching every single playthrough I could get my hands on YouTube. I don't know why, but I find them so addictive. So it's been a sad realization that I haven't played as many of these games. I only have Ride the Rails from the Iron Rails series. And obviously I've got Age of Steam and Railways of the World, but I want to have a crack at these more traditional sort of cube rail games. So my new oath, which is going to be on top of Tammany Hall, is play more cube rail games. I'm not going to use a specific game for it. We'll see what happens, and then maybe I can talk about it in a couple of episodes once I've had the opportunity to play more of these. And I'm really interested to see how the people I regularly play games with now find these. So if people will get, you know, as addicted as I am into this kind of game, we'll see.
Yeah. Very good. So an update.
What about you, Jules?
Yeah, update on my oath. My last one was to get a KDM campaign started. I actually was not thinking to play solo when I was thinking of this oath, but I have a group that are keen and interested, so I'm going to get that happening. But I guess technically I've actually started a campaign.
Cam, I'm not going to get you off that easily. Like, pressing a button that says start campaign on the Scribe app, it does not qualify.
Fair enough. Now, I can't actually remember if I've updated on this oath about to play Too Many Bones Unbreakable.
Ah, yes. You're still waiting for that, though?
I am still waiting for it, but I've played it now.
Played it with Mitch?
I played it with Mitch. I got to play Carcass, and that was actually a load of fun. I want to play a few more characters before I talk about my thoughts on the game, though, but I had a really good time.
That's great.
Now, as for a new oath, I swore a while ago to go back to the Cloudspire solo campaign, which I did.
Oh, here we go.
I did, and I did do it, and I went back. But I've still got another faction that's outstanding, so I want to go back and finish.
Which one?
That is the Uprising.
Oh.
So I want to finish the Uprising. So I, Jules Watson, swear I'm going to start the Uprising solo campaign for Cloudspire.
Excellent.
Well, that will bring us to the end of our show. Thank you so much, Def.
Thanks, Jules. It's been a great chat.
Yeah, it's been really good. And thank you all for listening. We really appreciate the support. And until next time, play more games.
Cheers.
Bye for now.